Coming up on this week's show, huge news for fans of Worms on the Amiga.
An amazing new NES expansion is on the way.
And we celebrate Soccer Kid with this week's guest, Matt Furness.
And the Retro Hour podcast is brought to you every week with our amazing friends at Bitmap Books. Now, if you're a fan of football games, you've got to check out their brand new book that just landed this week, A Tale of Two Halves, The History of Football Video Games, spanning all the classics from the earliest examples through Sensible Soccer, Kickoff, Matchday, FIFA, of course, in there, Pro Evolution Soccer, Championship Manager, lots more as well. We'll tell you more about that in just a bit, but you can check it out and the rest of their retro gaming collection on their website at bitmapbooks.com. Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 451, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
Me, Ravi Abbott.
And me, Joe Fox.
And great to have you joining us for the podcast that every single Friday celebrates all things about the golden age of video games, taking you back, reminiscing about the classics, and of course, bringing you up to speed on all the big developments in the wonderful world of retro from over the last 7 days, and bringing you veterans of the industry onto the podcast for a bit of a chat about their history every week. I'm hoping you're going to make it through this week's episode, Rav. You know, you've had lip fillers this week, is that right?
I got stung by a wasp, like, in this weather, on my mouth, which is really annoying. So, yeah, I've kind of got, like, really hard pronunciation this week, and I'm going to be blah, 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 like, with huge lips trying to speak.
Sometimes I wish it was a video podcast, and, you know, we could maybe send you audition to Love Island or something for next year's with you.
No one's going to see those pictures.
But anyway, never mind Love Island. This week, we're going to be talking about football in the second half of the show. Now, this is to celebrate. We just mentioned then Bitmap Books, who've been you know, an incredible supporter of this podcast for many years. They've just released their new book. It's out today, actually, called A Tale of Two Halves. Now, this explores all of the classic games in the genre of, well, for our American fans, they call it soccer. Over here, it's footy, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. And, like, there are so many games that, you know, kind of formed part of my history. If it's not just the management games, you've got the actual football playing games. We've got Soccer Kid that we're talking about today, which is a platformer, a football platformer, would you believe it? Also, this book just looks insane. Like, the level of detail, of course, Bitmap Books always look absolutely gorgeous. But the fact they've got shoelaces as the bookmark, I think that's absolutely wicked.
Yeah, no, it's a massive book. It's actually 628 pages and some absolute legends feature in the book as well. You know, interviews in there with the likes of, obviously, you know, we're talking about people like Jim Bagley, who worked on Striker, Kevin Toms, Football Manager. And also, our guest this week is coming onto the podcast to talk about Soccer Kid, among other things. Now, this is Matt Furness, who we're going to be joined by this week, who's actually been a very accomplished video game musician for many years. He kind of stopped in the video game industry in the mid-2000s, but back in the 80s and 90s, he did so many incredible things. Started as a playtester for Gremlin. He's part of a demo group as well called Magnetic Fields. Nothing to do with the magnetic fields that made the Lotus games. That's just a coincidence. But then he also did music on games like Speedball 2 he worked on, Alien 3, the Mortal Kombat series 2, and of course, Soccer Kid, which is going to be the main focus of this week's podcast. Now, have you ever played Soccer Kid before, Joe?
I have played it. You play as the little lad, and he's got like a yellow, I was going to say sports uniform, yellow football kit on. I really don't know football, but I have played it.
I can tell you've got distant memories of it, but it did go onto many different consoles. You know, the Amiga always had like a search for an icon, a kind of mascot. And to me, Soccer Kid was kind of up there with others like James Pond as well. It was really awesome because it was a platformer and it had like a different concept, which was kicking the ball around and using the ball, you know, to jump off, but also to hit enemies. It's a really interesting interview because we're talking about the design, but also the music in there. And, you know, Soccer Kid features all around the world as well. And of course, it would be called Football Kid, but, you know, they had to market these games to Americans. So they always called them Soccer.
Yeah, because I remember playing this on them. I think I first got a demo of it on CU Amiga magazine on their cover disc. And I remember my brother and I playing that like all the time. And then I got a copy for about £5 on the CD32, like secondhand a few years later. But yeah, really interesting game because, I mean, I'm not the biggest football fan in the world. You're kind of our resident footy fan, Ravi. Which we're going
to
listen
to. I've actually
gone
to football matches, unlike you guys.
Yes.
I'm going to take you along one day and feed you pies.
But, I mean, these kind of games, you know, a side-scrolling platform game that is kind of built around the concept of football, because it's basically Soccer Kid is a young lad with a massive head, if you've ever seen the cover of the game, who has to retrieve the World Cup because aliens come to Earth and basically split the World Cup up for some unknown reason and scatter all the parts around the world. So Soccer Kid has to go around using his football to take down enemies. Now, that might sound like quite a simple concept, but you think how much has to go into that, particularly the ball physics in that game. I remember being really on point.
Yeah, it had great mechanics. And, like, you know, having Matt on the podcast as well, he talks about other soundtracks that he did. And, you know, some games that Joe may have heard of, which is like Mortal Kombat, Alien 3 as well. Nice, so there's some really, really decent soundtracks out there as well. And, you know, it is great to talk about it as well as a speedball. So there's a lot of, you know, fast-paced music and that kind of rhythmic vibe. So it's a really interesting interview. I always love having these musical guests on.
Yeah, 100%. So to celebrate the launch of Bitmap Books' new A Tale of Two Halves, the history of football video games book that I'll link in the show notes, I'm going to be chatting to Matt Furness all about the history of Soccer Kid and lots more. He's our special guest coming up in around half an hour from now. Now, of course, first half of the podcast, that's when we have a little roundup of what's been happening in retro from over the last week. And I was talking about playing Soccer Kid on my Amiga then, another game that was an Amiga staple back in the 90s. They're obviously still going strong to this day. Is, of course, Worms.
Yes,
remember the story of Worms and how that kind of began?
Well, it was Andy Davidson entered a competition for Amiga format, and he didn't win the competition. He put Total Wormage in there, and that was the original title, from what
Design
I recall.
A game competition, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, and he was going around, you know, showing it at shows as well, and Team 17 picked up on it and said, this is pretty interesting. And then from then on, we've had millions of Worms games. And it was actually quite a late release in the Amiga. I think it was like one of the big last leases of life. And Worms went on to kind of dominate the world. It went on to so many different platforms and it had so many different versions. And it's still coming out today. But what we're talking about today is Amiga Worms, the Director's Cut. And I don't know, have you guys ever played the Director's Cut?
I had a demo of it, again, of CU Amiga. That was in the era when, you know, when they started doing the CD-ROMs back in the kind of mid to late 90s?
Yeah.
And there was a demo of it on one of the CU CDs. So I did play it on there. Then I remember them kind of putting on a load of third-party Worms levels that users had made. Because in that game, you could basically just design your own maps, couldn't you, in Deluxe Paint?
Yeah, so basically Worms DC made no commercial sense at all, because at that time, there was not that many people buying Amiga stuff. And
when did that come out? Was that like 97 or something?
I think it was 97 or 98, yeah. It's really late on anyway. But it was because Andy obviously loved the platform so much, and he said he wanted to make the best Amiga game ever. Now, the cool thing about it was it used so many things within the Amiga to make it, you know, a customizable game and one that would kind of go on forever. So he had added features that were in previous, that were in titles that came on the PC, like Worms 2, but also there were a few like extra things in there that were specifically for the Amiga. So it had a thing called Worms Bench as well, so you could install it and turn your workbench environment into a Worms-based
Your operating system background.
Yeah, like a theme. But also had the ability in Deluxe Paint to draw levels, which was amazing, and then import the levels. You could also import sound samples. So I remember they used to have South Park sound samples on one of the CDs, and they'd go in and you'd have Kick the Baby, and, you know.
You could swap out the L's with, like, you know, samples of your own, right?
Yeah, Cartman and stuff like that. Yeah. And it also had Cavern as well, which was a huge thing, where, you know, you had a roof on the Worms level, and that meant you could use grappling hooks and you could move around it. So really, it was a huge thing with Amiga user-created content. It's a pretty niche game because it was released at that time when the Amiga was kind of going. And then Worms Armageddon came out later on.
To me was when I was at university, we had a guy who kind of lived in the a nearby halls of residence who was a boyfriend of one of the girls who we all hung out with. And yeah, he had a Dreamcast and we'd often go there for like pre-drinks and playing Worms Armageddon. That was kind of, yeah, pre-night out ritual.
Yeah.
Like at uni back in the day.
That was meant to be an add-on initially for Worms 2, but they, you know, they entirely redid the engine and they also thought we'd release this as a full version. But the old engine, the original Worms engine, Worms DC, is like the prime of that. It is, and a lot of people like that because of the mechanics and like the way you can travel on it. And that's the way that they played it on the Amiga. So Andy's kind of come back and it looks like he's preserved his setup, which is really cool.
Well, he actually went to the Southwest Amiga Group.
Oh, swag, he kept
his,
great.
Yeah, he kept his Amiga 1200 that he made that Worms demo on back in the 90s, and then obviously the director's cut he made on the same machine too. Basically kept it in an attic for many years. Apparently tried to dig it out again in 2018, but obviously we know with Amiga 1200s, capacitors die and that kind of thing. So he said it wasn't running very stably, and he couldn't get the data off the hard disk, but he took it to the Southwest Amiga Group. And obviously, when you take things to user groups, there's always a bunch of very knowledgeable people who managed to get the hard disk backed up onto a compact flash card. So he's retrieved all his original files.
That's so important to have. You know, that's a piece of history. Yeah. And
recap the machine as well. So it's up and running again. So basically, Andy's back.
He's back, but also he's talking about doing an update to Worms DC.
Yes.
So this update sounds really interesting because if you hadn't fully explored it, there was stuff like the concrete donkey, which was, if you remember that, where a giant donkey would fall from the sky and like smash through levels and the whole level would vibrate. Seeing that was wicked. I'm hoping that Andy's going to add some new cool features to it, some new specific Amiga things that, you know, we haven't seen before. But also, he's asking for some new custom levels. And I think these custom levels, it's not just going to come in a level pack. I think it's going to be part of the official update. And he's asking demo groups to actually put out some of these levels. So, you know, have
to
some
make
of
them,
the
to create
demo
them.
Scene groups represented in the backgrounds and levels. And that's a really cool idea because the demo artists are absolutely amazing, you know, pixel art. So having those backgrounds, I'm sure we're going to get some amazing ones that might get converted to Armageddon or something, or, you know, help other Worms games as well.
Yeah, I mean, obviously I know that, you know, Worms is one of the longest running and, you know, most famous franchises in video games history. But having the guy that originally came up with the whole concept and the idea back on board again, and, you know, did you ever think that we'd see an update to Worms DC on the Amiga? Like,
I didn't think Worms DC because, to be honest, there were some bad Worms games that came out. There were a lot of.
Yeah, when it went 3D for me, it was a bit.
Yeah. There were a lot of Worms games for years. And then there were the standout ones like, you know, Armageddon, Worms DC, Worms World Party. I liked. Yeah. I thought WMD was a bit of a return to form as well. So, yeah, it's good to see him going back to that original engine.
Yeah, and they're going to be releasing this as a free release.
Yeah.
A Swedish computer event that's coming up in January. So, only got a few months to wait for
Worms.
Can
you tell that
DC.
I'm excited about this one?
Yeah, I mean, this is massive news in terms of, you know, games on the Amiga. I think, you know, biggest news we've probably had this year.
And I think it will remain an exclusive. You know, one of the best games gets an update, and that's a huge thing for bringing attention to the Amiga and to Worms.
Yeah, so look out for that free update to Worms for your Amiga. You know, if you haven't dug yours out for a while like Andy, might be a good time to get down to one of the user groups, of which there are many around the country, and get your old machine up and running again, ready for this. So we'll keep an eye on that and update you on the progress. Right, then let's talk NES, because, you know, back in the day, did you guys ever just kind of, you know, when you got a bit bored maybe, after you played a few games, or maybe when you were taking your console around a friend's house, let's look at all those interesting little covered up ports that you often see on the bottom and side of consoles and think, I wonder what that's for.
It's for sweets.
Good little hiding places, I hear. But someone's actually found a use for the expansion port on the NES. Now, obviously, these were designed to connect to the Famicom disk system in Japan. That's where it kind of connected to the bottom, which obviously wasn't a very widespread system. Never came outside of Japan, did it? The system, from what I know.
Yeah.
So that meant, over here, it didn't really have any use then, that expansion port on the bottom.
yeah, you're bang on there. So yeah, there's an expansion port on the bottom of the NES, which, like you say, we never got a Famicom over here, so it was never used, unlike the Super Nintendo and the Mega Drive, where they were used for like the Mega CD and the satellite view and stuff like that. And it's interesting that, you know, all the way back to the NES that we had these expansion ports on the back, you know, all the way in the 80s, thinking about, you know, the internet and disk drives and stuff like that, which is wicked. As you say, that meant that the, you know, the Western version of the Famicom, the NES, we never had a use for it. It was just on the bottom there. Often when you find them now secondhand and stuff, the little clip-on plate is missing and yeah, it's exposed and stuff like that. But there is now the NES hub, which has been made by 8-Bit Mods, which is, they've been making this for about a year now. But the reason we're talking
about
it's
in beta at the minute, isn't it? Yeah,
it's in beta, but they have just put it up for pre-order for £55. And it is a, I'd say a board that fits, connects to it, and then it is like an exposed motherboard.
I think it's an incredibly well-designed motherboard as well. Yeah, to fit in that kind of gap, but also be hidden and have all those features in such a way. I just think it's as a hardware nerd, I think it's a thing of beauty.
Just to explain kind of how this fits in, yeah, because obviously the expansion port on the bottom of the NES is recessed, isn't it? So by the looks of this board kind of fits around it and is hidden in the gaps around the connector. So
yeah, I guess it would clip in, you turn it upside down and then you don't see it, but you kind of get the functions that are available with it.
Yeah, so it is very, very snug, fits perfectly in. It's kind of like a T-junction, isn't it? That kind of fits into the recess. It looks beautiful, looks really, really cool. But in terms of the use of it, for me, the only thing it really kind of does is it's a controller port. Correct me if I'm wrong. Mm. It's a controller port so that you can plug kind of like other USB kind of controllers in there.
No, it's Bluetooth.
Bluetooth?
You'd have four Bluetooth controllers that you can sync then with, which I think it's amazing. In the first part, because it's got a wire going off it. That's the Bluetooth transmitter. But then it's also got audio expansion, so you can have extra channels on there as well. So games may be able to sound better, sound a bit wider with some of the extra channels that have been added on there. So I think it's, you know, it's got a bit more to it than it looks. But I think that whole Bluetooth connectivity is really good. It also has some outputs which are very interesting, because it has like CPU as well, which makes me think maybe there'd be something like putting a Raspberry Pi Zero on there in the future, and then you know, having the ability to basically have that as a co-processor helping games, you know, may get a bit of a speed up, some extra RAM in there or something. I think it's an interesting achievement, yeah, and it's got a lot of possibilities for the future. Main thing, four-player Bluetooth support is just like, wow.
They're going to be making an add-on so you can plug in their Super Nintendo controllers to it as well.
You see, for me, I didn't realise it did all that. I just took it as like, it's got slightly better audio maybe, and then it just kind of gets rid of the multi-tap for the four players.
The good thing about this is it obviously you can kind of blast updates to it via USB by the looks of it. So they're saying, you know, there's also potential that maybe they could integrate the, there's like a Famicom disk system emulator that they may be able to integrate on this at some point as well. So you could play disk system games using this.
That's pretty cool actually to get because obviously everybody can emulate disk system and stuff like that these days. But I guess to have that running on original PAL or NTSC hardware is pretty cool.
Yeah, so I think for the price you mentioned as well, and they reckon this is going to be released in December, so only a couple of months to wait. I think, you know, £54.98. Pre-orders available now on the website 8bitmods.com, which I'll link in the show notes.
Just don't drink a cup of tea next to your NAS and spill it, because it'll hit the board.
Important safety tip, Ravi. So if you want to pre-order that, like you said, I think, you know, it's a starting point, like you said, Joe. It's, you know, basically starting point, get some extra control mechanism on the NES, but there's a lot more future potential in there as well, I think.
Kind of combined with like an additional CPU and an overdrive or something, it would be bonkers.
Sure, people will find some interesting uses, so I'll link that in the show notes.
Networking or something,
Now, you guys, fans of the band Green Day. Now, Joe's our resident rocker. What's your thoughts on Green Day?
Oh, you know what? I'm not a fan of Green Day.
What?
No, I know.
Too soft for you.
No, well, yeah, well, but no, I never got into them, to be honest. You know, I don't love them. I don't hate them. I don't mind their singles. I know, obviously, how iconic they are and, you know, what they've done for kind of like rock and punk rock and stuff like that, and how iconic they are and how iconic Dookie is as an album and the songs that are on there and stuff. But I other than kind of like Basket Case on that album. Is Basket Case on that album?
No. Yes.
Yeah, no, it is.
Is it on Dookie?
Yeah, it is.
Oh, okay. I was going to say I'm a huge fan. I'm wrong. Yeah. Yeah,
Joe doesn't like him. He knows the album track.
That's literally, and then other than like American Idiot, you know, which was like, what, 2004 or something, a few songs on there. I couldn't say I'm a fan, no. But
well, maybe this will sell it to you, because Green Day are celebrating 30 years of the album Dookie, like you said, which came out in 1994. I think this is definitely a concept album, isn't it? Because they're calling this a demake. And basically what they've done is they've took every track from the album and put it onto different pieces of retro technology.
I think this is really cool. They've done it on limited technology. And a quick crazy Green Day story was year 2000. We heard they were playing in the city. So we were grebs, skaters. We went down there, played on a little guitar, Green Day songs outside, raised enough money to get some tickets, and all our mates went in and saw them. And we're like, nice. Yeah, this is awesome at the Ice Stadium.
How much were the tickets?
Oh, we bought them off some scalpers, so they weren't much.
A tenner or something.
Yeah, yeah. But I think this is awesome because they're doing not only like, you know, a release for making loads of money or kind of, you know, a trip to nostalgia. They're doing it for multiple formats and, you know, they're doing it on like that vinyl wax cylinder, which is just insane to see. Teddy Ruxpin as well. It's one
Do you want to hear the Teddy Ruxpin? So what they've done is, like we said, there's basically every different Green Day track off the album, they've ported to different devices. Like, you know, Burnout's on the player piano, like I said. They ported it to a doorbell, a toothbrush, an 8-track, a mini disc, which I can't imagine.
Yeah, which I've done anyway. Yeah, exactly, still use mini disc, yeah.
Yeah, and you mentioned the Teddy Ruxpin. Now, this is a song called Chump on Teddy Ruxpin, which, again,
well,
sound that different.
Would you look at that? It's time for me to sing Chump, my favorite track on Dookie.
Now, before we get a copyright strike, I imagine that all this is doing is, you know, like stuff like Teddy Ruxpin. That just basically had like something like a tape recorder inside, didn't it? Or similar technology.
Yeah,
that
yeah.
Just basically playing like audio.
Converted it for the format as well. And I just think the choice of stuff's cool. Like, you know, the Big Mouth, Billy Bass, Fish as well, which sings along.
You know, I do like that one.
Yeah. I mean, it's a nice idea to kind of release something in formats where they know it's not going to be, you know, commercially viable at all.
Yeah.
Well, this one here is a Fisher Price record.
I think I had one of those when I was a kid.
Yeah, I think I did as well.
Kids, yeah.
Don't nod off, boys. But the interesting one for us, Joe.
Mm-hmm.
The Game Boy.
Game Boy, welcome to paradise.
We're rocking. That's my favourite, I think.
There's a doorbell one as well.
Yes.
Which I love.
I didn't pull a clip of that one.
I think there's a toothbrush as well, an electric toothbrush, like a 90s. Obviously, it's all stuff that was available in 1994, which is very cool. They are releasing it as like very, very limited editions, but they're prizes that you have to sign. So you have to sign up. You have to be a part of like the mailing list, and then you sign up, and I think you can win it, with the Bass only having one being produced. And then there's like three of the Teddy Ruxpins, but then there's like, I think there's 25 of the Game Boy cartridges and then 50 floppy disks.
It's so a good way to bring attention again
yeah.
To a band. Like, yeah, I bet you were like, oh, I wish I could have done this idea when you had Japan back in the day.
Would have got one sale.
Joe's new album's on. Yeah, Joe's new album's only available on Teddy Ruxpin.
Yeah, Green Day a little bit bigger. They're, I thought you were going to say a band that aren't relevant anymore, bring them back to relevancy. I think Green Day have never not been big, you know, for years now. So, but yeah, very cool. A very, very cool way to celebrate 30 years of their, I guess, was it their debut album or their the album that made them big? I'm not sure.
I'm not really? The expert. I just saw them once.
Just someone to pull it
was
up
a good
on that.
Album. Yeah, there you go.
So yeah, awesome way, I think, to and a very novel way to celebrate 30 years of the album. Might get a bit annoying brushing your teeth with it playing the song Pulling Teeth morning and night for like how long the toothbrush lasts. But there you go. Imagine there's going to be a few of these on eBay at some point. But yeah, really good course. I'll link that up in the show notes if you want to get involved in that. Now, just one more story before we hop into our guest, Matt Furness, talking about Soccer Kid in a moment. And I love these. Now, this is the awesome folks at Digital Eclipse who are doing another one of their interactive documentaries. Now, this is going to be their, it's been their fourth one now, isn't it? They did the Atari 50. They did the Jeff Minter story and the Jordan Mechner one as well, the making of Karateka. So this one is going to be another one of those. It's basically play the games and watch a documentary and find out the story behind the games that you're playing.
And it's
this time about Tetris.
Yeah, it's kind of like a complete history as well. So you can, you know, get everything and play on it. And that was a big case with the Jeff Minter one as well. You know, with the Konix launch that was in the game. Tetris, obviously, is absolutely huge as well. And you've got 15 plus games on this. I kind of love the development of Tetris and, you know, the different types of games. Do you remember your first time that you played it and, like, all the different versions? Was it the Game Boy version?
Yeah, it definitely would have been because I was actually a little bit older when I realised there was all different versions of Tetris because when I met my girlfriend, now my wife, she was like, oh, yeah, I love Tetris on the SNES. And I was like, eh? So I always definitely the Game Boy one thinking about it.
Yeah, it's interesting that there's so many ports on here, isn't there? Because, again, I mean, yeah, I played it on my friend's Game Boy. I remember my friend Sean coming to, when we moved away, he came to visit me in the summer holidays and he just got a Game Boy for Christmas, probably 90, 91 maybe. Yeah, and just playing that like nonstop throughout that summer. But again, I mean, it was on so many different platforms. I think having this, is like a documentary that's going to be over 90 minutes long of documentary footage, kind of exploring the full history of Tetris and a lot of the different versions that came out as well. So, I mean, I think you guys watched the kind of docudrama
that
was on Apple TV a year or two back, which, you know, hearing that story of how the game was developed behind the Iron Curtain and, you know, the battle of the Western companies to sign it, really interesting to see. And obviously, the great thing about these Digital Eclipse games is that you can, you know, obviously when you're hearing about a certain version of it, you can hop out and play it. Although, looking at the list, am I mistaken here? The Game Boy version's not on it, which seems like a massive omission to me.
Yeah. I mean, there's, like you say, there's quite a few games here on the list, but you've got the Apple II version, the Famicom version, then the Famicom version of Hattress, which I'd never heard of until now.
Yeah, apparently it was made by Pajutnov, Hattress.
It's a spin-off from what I can see, right. Which utilizes hats that look like chess pieces.
Never played it.
And then, yeah, Hattress for the Game Boy, Tetris 2, Hattress for the NES, Super Tetris 2 for the Famicom, for the SNES, Tetris Battle Gaiden, which looks really cool actually, Super Tetris 2 Generation, Super Tetris 3, Super Bomb Bliss for the Game Boy, and then Super Bomb Bliss DX. So you're right, the original Game Boy version that I think is the one that many, many millions of people are probably familiar with doesn't appear to be on here, which is crazy.
That's got to be a Nintendo thing, hasn't it?
Yeah.
They must have put a blocker up somewhere. There's no way that.
But then there's the Famicom and SNES versions on here, which is weird.
Notoriously it was hard with the rights for Tetris, as we saw in the movie.
Yeah.
So I can imagine, you know, putting this together was probably pretty tough, and kind of making those decisions, because if it did have every kind of Tetris game, it'd probably be over, you know, 200-300. I remember playing PD games of Tetris and unofficial releases and, you know, all sorts. So yeah, it I think I've chose some key ones though, and they've got the original in there as well, the Soviet version, which is good.
Yeah, and I think when you buy these though, I think, you know, 100% they will definitely cover the Game Boy version of it. I mean, in the documentary, there's no way you couldn't. So I imagine they talk about it. I mean, the thing is, everyone's played the Game Boy version of Tetris, but I think it would be nice to have that in there for completionist's sake.
For sure.
Yeah, but I mean, it's only a month, you know, a month till release yet. Maybe something will get sorted out before it comes out, fingers crossed. But I think, you know, obviously, if any game deserves a full kind of massive 90-minute documentary and a bunch of games kind of celebrated in this style, Tetris is definitely a good one. And I love the fact they're doing these as well. Any other games you think would be worthy of this treatment? I'm thinking, like, you know, Street Fighter or something would be
Arknight.
Awesome to see the history of that.
It'd be worth it, I think, because there's so many versions of that.
Yeah, so Digital Eclipse, just obviously they're owned by Atari these days, aren't they? Yeah, Donkey Kong would be an interesting one.
Yeah,
FIFA, that would be the biggest one, wouldn't it? But that would be like just go to a charity shop and you could probably get all of them.
Yeah, buy the complete history of FIFA in my life. That's research. So, yeah, only about a month to wait for that now. It's going to be available on all current platforms, Switch, PS5, PS4, Xbox as well, and PC via Steam and GOG, coming out on the 12th of November. So I'll put that and, of course, all the rest of the stories. You don't have to Google around. I save you the job every week by putting them in the show notes on your podcast app, or you can head to our website, theretrohour.com, and click straight through. Right, we have a couple of extra stories on the way for our patrons in just a minute. Of course, we do that every week on the podcast because we chop the adverts out for the patrons. So that means, you know, we don't want to shortchange you. So we give you another two or three news stories every week. And for everybody else, Matt Fern is coming up in just a sec. Before we do that, though, let's take a quick second to give a huge thank you to one of our longest running supporters and a service that we are massive fans of. And of course, it is the one with the sound effect, which we all know by now. It's amazing. It's Shopify.
Oh, yes. You
know, huge fans of Shopify, aren't we?
I love Shopify. You know, it's such a good system, and it's so quick, and it's just really helped us. You know, we've set up a store on Shopify, and it's fantastic. We don't have to get that, you know, support and stuff out of bed, wake them up. You know, there's 24-hour support that you can just contact straight away. It's interesting because I used to do web development, and I used to you know, do e-commerce stuff as well, and it involved plugins, updating, all kinds of nightmares. And
it always breaks, doesn't it, when you do WordPress plugins?
It always breaks, and that can lose your sales, can't it? Like, just overnight, you know. So it's really important to have that kind of up, and Shopify works really well. It handles the shipping so well as well. You're able to, you know, purchase labels within it, print them out straight away, especially with a world of customs at the moment and all kinds of stuff. It's really important to, you know, have that defined, and it works in zones, which is really good. So you can choose like custom zones and then send to those places and have like physical and digital products as well.
Yeah, I mean, we've been selling our books. There are still some available, the retro books on our website, going to get one via Shopify. And really, it is the all-in-one commerce platform, and it's revolutionizing millions of businesses all around the world. So if you've got a bit of a side hustle going on right now, or maybe you sell things online or in person as well, they simplify it all. So you can focus on the things that you want to do, grow your business, let them cover all the sales channels, and even do those little shop ready point of sale systems. We're using them at your Amiga event, won't we, Ravi?
Yeah. Just, and the thing is, you can have all your inventory, everything on there straight away. Yeah. You know, have set fees as well for stuff, and then it makes it really quick, and that sale, you know, it's an instant decision then.
It takes all the headache out and pretty much does it all for you. So you can just focus on the things you love doing and not this side of it. So let Shopify do it for you. And even they can sell across your social media marketplaces, you know, Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, full of industry-leading tools ready to ignite your growth. And of course, give you complete control over your business and your brand. And the best thing is you don't have to learn new skills, no design skills, no coding, nothing like that. And there is that extensive business course library and support ready to support you every step of the way. So if you sell anything at all, it is time to get serious today and give Shopify a try. Now, we want you to give it a go. And actually, it's a no-brainer. You can try Shopify for just £1 a month on a trial period. So use our link. The note that we sent you helps out the podcast, shopify.co.uk/retrohour. All lowercase, shopify.co.uk/retrohour. I'll put that in the show notes as well. And get ready to take your business to the next level today and hear a lot more of this. Right, then next, going to be celebrating all things Soccer Kid. and video game music as well, with our special guest Matt Furness. He's coming up next on the Retro Hour podcast. You're listening to the Retro Hour podcast, and it is time to welcome on this week's very special guest. And you know, if you're a regular listener, Ravi and I love doing audio episodes, you know, being the audio nerds. We always love getting technical and talking about the soundtracks to some of our favourite games of all time. And our guest this week has worked on some iconic game soundtracks, including series like Alien, worked on Alien 3, The Lost Vikings we're talking about as well, The Terminator, Speedball 2, Soccer Kid that we're definitely going to go deep into as well. So let's welcome on our guest this week, Matt Furness. How's it going, Matt?
I'm doing very well, thank you. And thanks for having me on the show. It's lovely to be here.
Now, we always like to go kind of back to day one on the podcast and find out where our guest journey began. I mean, what originally got you into video games and computers then? Do you remember like the first time that you ever played one or got one?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I was absolutely obsessed with the seaside amusement arcades, you know, that we have in Britain, or we had a lot of it at the time. And I would, you know, anytime we went on holiday, I would just make a beeline straight to all the arcades. You know, this was in the late 70s, so there was still quite a lot of electromechanical games, as well as, you know, old pinballs and then video games, you know, Space Invaders and Asteroids and those kind of things. So I was absolutely obsessed with all that.
What was your kind of a seaside gaming zone of choice?
We did go to Blackpool quite a lot because my parents' friends had a guest house there. And obviously Blackpool is kind of like the mecca for those kind of things. But, you know, any chance I had, if we went to a campsite, even if they had a little, you know, some games there, I'd want to play those. Or, you know, anywhere we went, if there was an amusement arcade, I was in there spending all my 10p's.
So what about your first home system then? Which machine did you first get at home? And did you have to convince your parents to get it? How did that kind of work?
We didn't own any consoles. I think we may have had a Pong machine in the 70s. And I desperately did want to have an Atari 2600, but we just, you know, they were really expensive, as you know, and especially the games. But what we would do is, at the time, the independent video tape rental places, they would also rent, the one that we had in our town would rent systems. So you could actually rent an Atari 2600 and some games. So that's, you know, what I would do. I'd rent one for the weekend and a couple of games. And, play those. But as for owning one, we never owned one, and so we went the, you know, the home computer route, like a lot of British kids did. And my first system was a ZX81, which I had for a year or two, and then, you know, after that we had the Spectrum, and then, you know, everything else that came after.
Well, other than the wonderful tape loading sounds as well, were there any kind of soundtracks that really stood out to you and gave you a big lasting impression?
Oh yeah, absolutely. For me, it was, of course, the Commodore 64, which I didn't own back then, but I did have friends that owned them, and you know, the sound that it could generate was just amazing to me. And I would, you know, listen to all the loading tunes from, you know, Martin Galway and all those kind of folks that were making great music in the early years. Rob Hubbard, people like that. And I would record, you know, all the music onto tapes to listen to, and all those kind of things. Yeah.
So you're based in Sheffield then. I mean, what was the scene like in Sheffield at that time, like for computer games and shops and that kind of thing?
It was amazing because we had, like I said, we had Just Micro, which was a very popular tiny shop, but like in Aladdin's Cave, just stuffed with systems and games. And that was owned by the owners that owned Gremlin Graphics, who were upstairs. So that was the number one place. But there was another place called Gemsoft across the street, and they did like more 16-bit. That was one of the first places that had the Amigas and STs, and we'd go in there and, you know, hang out and play games and play demos on the systems there. So there's probably, yeah, those two are the main ones. There's a couple of other places. And we also had a computer club that I used to go to, where, you know, you'd get all your Amiga or your Commodore 64, put it in a bag and get on the bus and go into town, and then you just meet and have a morning playing games or discussing things. So yeah, it had a good scene, absolutely.
Well, I heard out of that you kind of became an unofficial playtester for Gremlin. So tell us a story there. How did that happen?
Yeah, so that was on one of my usual days when I should have been at school probably, and I was in just Micro in the centre of Sheffield in the shop. And occasionally the office upstairs, they would need some testing done on, you know, games they were working on. So they'd send someone down to see if there was any kids that want to go up and, you know, try some new games, which of course I was like first in line. Yeah, I want to go up there and play some games. So they said, yeah, well, you come up a couple of hours, we'll give you a can of pop and some crisps and you play some games. So I played Mask 2 on the Commodore 64, I think it was. And I don't really remember much about it, if I found any bugs or any problems with it, but I certainly enjoyed doing that, yeah.
And you got to meet Ben Daglish, is that right?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. So I did know that Ben worked up there in his office, and I was a huge fan of his music, of course. So I, you know, after I'd done this testing, I said, well, would it be okay, could I actually, you know, maybe meet Ben Daglish? And they were, oh yeah, it's cool, you know, you can just go knock on his door and see if he's in. So I, you know, went over there, knocked on the door, and Ben was right there with his synthesizers. And yeah, he was a lovely guy, and he, you know, he's really nice to me, because I was probably only 15 or 16 at the time, probably 15 years old still. And you know, he was really, really gracious with his time and showed me what he was working on and gave me some software I could use on my Atari ST so I could start, you know, making my own, you know, music, those kind of things. Yeah, so that was an amazing day.
That must have been quite good to, like, get a nudge from one of the legends and kind of, you know, see his setup and his working process.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Because, you know, he was such a great musician, and, you know, he had, you know, equipment that I could only dream about, you know, really cool synthesizers and mixing desks and all sort of crammed into his little office there, yeah.
Well, had you had any, like, formal study with music at all, or any interest in, like, creating your own music before? And then how did you translate that onto video game music and sound design?
I didn't really have any formal training other than, you know, music lessons at school. So I just kind of taught myself how to play piano a little bit and how to, you know, program early synthesizers. And then I, you know, learned to program a little bit. So that kind of came into it. And then it sort of all started to kind of blend together into that. Well, I had a little bit of programming knowledge and a little bit of music knowledge. So I kind of put them together. And of course, then once I did get a Commodore Amiga, that was a really good system and easy to write music, because there was a lot of software like Soundtracker already available. So I could use the Amiga and make some music that way.
So before the Amiga, what was your kind of setup? And then I guess you just like dropped everything and just went fully into the Amiga.
Yeah, well, I didn't really have a setup until then. I did at that point, did have a Commodore 64 by then, but I couldn't really do much with it, because I, you know, I didn't have the disk drive or the cartridge, and I didn't really have people I knew or where to get the software. I think that was the problem, but it was, you know, sort of that problem fixed itself when I got the Amiga, because there was so much more of a community that I could reach and, you know, get the software I needed.
Friends to swap discs with.
Totally. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So how did you make your first steps into the industry then? Because I've seen that looking at your Moby games, which I know is not always accurate. We often get saying that. But the first game you're credited with on there is a game called Tubin. It was on the Amstrad CPC, the MSX, the Spectrum, Amiga, C64. So tell us about kind of your first steps into working in the industry, and where did the idea come from that you wanted to be a video game musician?
Like I say, you know, I was obsessed with arcade games. And then sort of in the early 80s, once they started to introduce games with, you know, more advanced sound, I it was just really attractive to me. To me, because that was the kind of music I'd listen to. Is I used to like listen to a lot of Kraftwerk and Jean-Michel Jarre, sort of synthesizer music, and that was like a sort of close analogy to me. Whereas, like, you've got these games that have just got sound chips making, you know, synthesizer music. I do remember, you know, certain games that I thought were had really amazing like music and sound. If you remember, there was a game called Gyrus by Konami that had, yeah, a really cool soundtrack, and I, you know, distinctly remember that. And a lot of the old Atari games back then, they had particularly good sound and music and really good hardware. So when the music played the machine, it was like real bassy, and it just had a lot of, you know, nice quality to it. And I, you know, I just decided that's what I want to do. I wanted to do that for a job. So I'd been doing a little bit of work for the, you know, the demo scene in Sheffield. And so what I did is I, you know, I recorded my what I thought were my best songs onto audio tapes. And then I just, you know, found the addresses of software houses and developers and publishers, and I, you know, sent the tapes out. Just didn't really know who I was sending them to, and just put, you know, to the manager, whoever it is, and please listen to my tape. And I did send it to Tech, who were the software developers that broke off from Gremlin, a couple of years earlier. And they were just based in Rotherham, which is fairly close to Sheffield. It's 30 minutes on a bus, basically. And I was amazed because they did get back to me and they said, oh, we do need someone to do sound. I guess they were using Ben Daglish at the time, who was still at Gremlin, but they wanted to have somebody in-house. But they also said, Tech said, oh, we also need someone to work this thing called a scanner we have and scan in graphics, because they thought digitized graphics were going to be like this big thing. And this is 1989, of course. So, you know, I went over there. They gave me an interview with the three directors of the company. And they were just, well, let's just take a chance on him and just see how it goes and give him a trial. And so, you know, I went over there on the bus and took, I think I even brought my own computer and things over there because they didn't want to spend any money just in case it didn't work out. You know, Tubin was actually one of the games they were working on. So when I, you know, went to the Tech office, it was incredible because they had arcade games right there in the lobby. And these were the games they were working on at the time, which was Tubin was one that was Chase HQ, Planet of the Robot Monsters. I don't know, there's maybe six or seven games there. And Tubin was one of the first ones and they needed sound. So I got to work on that and record the sound from the, you know, from the arcade machine onto tape and then try to, you know, convert it to the Amiga and Commodore 64 and the home systems.
That's pretty cool because many people didn't actually have like the arcade unit when they were doing those conversions as well. So that must have really helped.
Yeah. I've read and heard from friends I have now that said at the time, oh, they didn't even have the machine. They would have to go to an arcade with a video camera and sort of record it and then try to do it that way. But we were fortunate in that, yeah, we did have the arcade machines, and then we did have some particularly clever, you know, programmers. You know, there was Peter Harrop and Sean Hollingworth, who were the two co-technical directors, and they're very smart guys, and they knew how to, you know, take the ROMs from the machine and extract your graphics and sound and different things from the ROMs, which I think helped give the conversions, you know, more authentic, because it wasn't somebody trying to interpret the graphics. We could actually use a lot of the original graphics, which was really good.
Well, Sheffield back then must have been the kind of center of the synth universe as well, with so much, you know, cool talent coming out of the city. You'd also discovered like the demo scene, and there was like demo music. And what are your kind of favorite memories of that? And how did you like, you know, enter the demo scene?
I think, yeah, I probably did meet someone in Sheffield in one of the shops that, you know, somebody that was into the Amiga and things. And I think there's a guy called Mark. I can't remember his last name, but he said he had a demo crew and he wanted someone to do music. And, you know, my music wasn't particularly good at that stage. It was pretty basic, but he was like, well, just, you know, write some tunes. We'll put it on some demos. And there was a couple of early magnetic field demo discs called Sound Attacks 1 and 2, I think they were called. And I put some Amiga, you know, they had my Amiga music on these sort of music demo discs. And, you know, we put those out and I think they were kind of popular. But a lot of people get their demos over the post. There was like these sort of postal services where they'd list their demos in a magazine and you'd, you know, phone a number and tell them that which demo you wanted and they'd send you a disc.
Well, in a jiffy bag.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. It was pretty exciting. And, you know, I used to love playing all the, you know, the really good demos from the really good teams that were in Europe. And I did actually become friends with Matt Simmons, who was, I think he went by the name of Format, and he was a really amazing demo musician.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah. And he did work for, I think he worked for Core Design for a number of years. So I used to swap sample discs with him over the, you know, through the post. So that's kind of how I got into the demo scene a little bit. Yeah.
So what productions did you work on then for Magnetic Fields, and how did the kind of the setup work? So obviously this was the pre-internet era then? Was it just kind of messages in Grapevine Disc Magazine, and how did that kind of work?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. I didn't have a modem at the time, and I didn't have a car. So it was, I just remember this guy, Mark, who kind of ran the demo crew. He was a little older and he had a car, so he would sort of just drive around and kind of coordinate everything between, you know, whoever was doing the sound and whoever was doing the programming and, you know, who was doing the graphics. And yeah, just, you know, swap discs. He'd, you know, come around, hey, Matt, have you got the disc with music? He'd take the disc from me, drive it to the programmer's house. And, you know, that was how it was done.
Well, one of the great, amazing soundtracks on the Amiga was Speedball 2. And that was done with Nation 12 as well, which was John Fox, who was actually from Ultravox originally, an absolutely amazing synth composer. What was it like working on that music? And did you meet John Fox and Nation 12 and like work alongside them?
For that one, the only involvement I have, and it's a weird story with Speedball 2, was actually the European Mega Drive version. Okay. Because they did do a Sega Genesis conversion, you know, for the US market. And I don't know who did the sound, but they didn't like the sound for that version. They were like, oh, this, well, the sound on the US versions, it's not good enough. We need to get it redone. So they contacted me to just redo the sound for the European version before they published it. So the European version of Speedball 2 actually has a completely different soundtrack to the US one. But yeah, I just took the Amiga music, converted it in my head as best I could, and put it onto the Mega Drive.
Okay, because that's really interesting, because they also did Into the Wonderful, which was the Gods soundtrack, and that was kind of, you know, the idea of having musicians, you know, making soundtracks of video games, which was a weird kind of crossover back then.
Yeah, it was strange, but there was a little bit of that going on, especially, I remember, yeah, with Bitmap Brothers, because they were using Bomb the Base, I think they did for, is it Xenon 2?
Yes.
Yeah,
and, so Betty Boo on Magic Pockets. Yeah,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I remember those. Yeah,
and if anybody's listening, that's kind of into exploring that, there's an album called Electrophere as well by Nation 12 that actually has like the God soundtrack on it, and quite a lot of the samples used in Speedball 2. It's quite amazing to listen to it nowadays and hear those samples kind of pop in there.
Nice. Well, let's get into Soccer Kid as well, which you know, my brother and I got many memories of, you know, long summer holidays playing Soccer Kid. Really interesting game, and kind of like a mixture of, you know, obviously football mechanics in there, but also a great platformer game too. And also features in Bitmap Book's new book, A Tale of Two Halves, that I know you're in there as well, Matt. So how did you get involved with Soccer Kid? I heard that you actually did a bit more than just the audio on that game, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I did do quite a bit on the actual game design, and I did design some levels. But the sort of idea for the character was really a number of people that came up with that. And that was, I think, you know, we did do a game called Mad Professor Mariotti, which was just, it wasn't a hit. It was a very small platform game we did at Chrysalis. And they wanted to do a sequel for some reason. And at the time, there was a guy called Dean Lester who was running our Tech London office, the development studio there. And he said, well, could you do something like, the professor has to kick a ball around? And it was just this sort of, you know, just this sort of idea that the Dean had. And I was thinking, well, and I thought about it a bit, and I thought it might be an interesting mechanic to use a ball as a weapon and then maybe use it as a soccer ball. And then I thought, well, you know, you've got this cool idea of this character that uses a ball to kick, but that doesn't really work with a professor. It doesn't make sense. So it should be a kid who plays football. Yeah, makes sort of the obvious pairing of a football, and then it's this kid that plays football. And I was pretty heavily into console platform games at the time, especially, you know, things coming out of Japan, and at the time Sonic was, you know, really big. So I thought, well, maybe you could do something kind of like that, where the character looks kind of Sonic, and you can give him sort of big feet because he needs us to kick the ball, and give him the big head and make him kind of cute and a little chibi looking. And then, you know, so I proposed that idea, and the top brass at Chrysalis said, well, yeah, we could go with that. And there was quite a few of the lads were pretty into football as well at Chrysalis as a sport. So we, you know, kind of quickly put a little team together just to see if that would work, and worked out some ball logic. I remember Peter Harrop worked on all the mathematics for the ball and how it would bounce around, and then it got passed on to another programmer, Nigel, who sort of worked on all the game logic. And so I was, you know, working on sound and design and some of the levels, which we had a level editor. And I think the lead artist was the first artist was a guy called Neil Adamson, who was an amazing graphics artist who worked on a lot of Dizzy games back in the 80s and things, and he did a lot of the really amazing graphics for it. So yeah, so that was it. And then we didn't really have a formal design. We sort of designed as we went along, I think that was pretty common back then. And we just put together what different places Soccer Kid could go and tried to devise some kind of a story to kind of glue it together. Yeah.
Did it feel kind of refreshing doing a soccer platformer? Because there was so many kind of football related titles out there, you know, management games that were quite boring to look at, you know, but then you had other great games like Swaz out there and Kickoff and stuff. It must have felt a bit like, oh, we're doing something new here.
It did feel a little new. And I know there were a few other soccer platforming games like Marco's Magic Football that came out sort of around the same time. But, to be honest, I'm pretty sure they did steal the idea from us, because I think that was Domark, and we worked pretty closely with them. So I think that maybe one of their producers who'd been sniffing around our office had took that one. But I think we were the first to do a game based on that concept. Yeah. And it was fresh and something different to the usual management and, regular football games.
And the soundtrack felt really football-y as well. And like, obviously you played like Sensible Soccer from Sensible, and they'd have like a banging soundtrack in there as well, and it just kind of had that bouncy soccer kind of, it's hard to describe, but what were your influences for it?
Yeah, influences really just coming from other console platform games. So I did want to have Soccer Kid be where the music and sound effects play at the same time, which was not super common back then for the Amiga. A lot of games, if you remember, you want to have music or sound effects. Yeah. So with Soccer Kid, I wanted to have both, which is a little challenging on the Amiga because there's not so many sound channels and you've only got so much memory. And I did want each zone to have its own music and for the bosses to have their own music. So I wanted to have a lot of different tunes and things, and they're more like a Japanese console game, lots of music. And then, like you said, I wanted to have it be sort of sports or football, give feel into it and have some sort of crowds in the background and a referee's whistle and those kind of things, yeah.
And it was weird as well. There was always this kind of push for football songs. I know there was like Manchester United used to have their own hits and like Forest and stuff like that going out, until you really had like World in Motion and the John Barnes rap and stuff like that. But it was always a weird kind of footy music genre, wasn't there?
Yeah, it was a little strange. We never did a top 40 hit based on Soccer Kid or anything.
I'd have bought that. Yeah. So you mentioned about the sound effects there as well, and I've kind of got a couple of questions on that. I'm wondering, first of all, kind of technically, as you said, I mean, a lot of Amiga games back then, they did make you choose music or sound effects, which was always frustrating. So first of all, I mean, how did you manage to do what some other programmers couldn't do and get them both in the game?
Just very clever sort of use of reduced sample rates and then applying different EQs so that when you have a sample that's been really downsampled, it doesn't sound so good. You can kind of bring some of that, the vibrancy of the top end back into it if you apply filters, and you just have to be really careful and count every byte. I'm sure, lots of guests have worked on games in the past who told you this. Every byte counts, and you're constantly trying to optimize and just trying to get a byte here, a little bit of memory there. And can I just optimize this and just trim a bit here and there until eventually you get everything to squeeze right in.
And how did you make the sound effects? Because I mean, I know there were sample discs and that kind of thing, but what was kind of the process of like the referee's whistle and the ball sound effect and stuff like that?
Those I created them on this. I had a synthesizer, a Yamaha, which I knew how to program sound, so I could actually make that Yamaha synthesizer create sound effects and then record those into the sampler on the Amiga and then edit and just refine the sound until it worked.
It was a kind of distinctly European game as well. How well did it do in other markets? Of course, you had the name soccer to kind of appeal to the American market as well.
Yeah, I do remember, I'm not sure how well it sold outside of Europe, but they did change the name and some of the artwork for different regions. So I think in the US it was called Kid Cleats, and I character had a couple of different designs. If you see like the 3DO version, he looks different. And I think it is called Soccer Kid there, but then on Super Nintendo, it's called Kid Cleats. And then there's a Japanese version where it looks completely different. And it's kind of like manga style artwork on the box. You know, he's got like blue crazy hair and it's, you know, Japanese style of artwork. But then when you play the game, that we, you know, none of the graphics in the game were changed. So it was a little odd to see this blue-haired soccer kid on the cover, and then you play the game and it's just the regular European one.
I've just Googled that. That's crazy, yeah.
Yeah.
It looks totally different.
But there's a lot of different ports of that. I mean, there's an unofficial version, which is actually on cartridge you can get for the Jaguar. There's a Game Boy Advance version.
There's a 3DO one as well, yeah. Isn't there? Yeah,
and 3DO one, yeah.
CD32 version, I remember it had this intro on there as well, like an animated intro. Do you remember that at all?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that intro, I think we used it for any of the CD versions, which would, like you said, yeah, the CD32 3DO had this, and we contracted an animation studio, I think, in, I don't know where they were based, somewhere in the UK, and we gave them the ideas of what we wanted for this intro, and then they produced the animation, which is like a little, it's probably what, it's a couple of minutes long intro sequence, and then I had to then work out how to put sound to this, which was actually the first time I'd ever had to do sound for video, so I had to work out how to use the multi-track and the time codes and all those kind of things, and we bought, you know, some a little bit more professional studio equipment for the office, and then we hired a voice guy to do the, you know, the voiceovers and the sound, the speech, and a few other things as well. But it was quite challenging to work that out, because I really didn't know what it was doing or who I could ask who could tell me how to do it either. So yeah,
you couldn't watch a YouTube tutorial back then, could you?
No, nothing. No.
Well, interestingly, it was ported to Windows Mobile, but yeah, I think, you know, smaller platforms it was quite nice for. But there was a Lynx port sometime that was kind of in development, but I don't know what happened there. Do you know anything about that?
I don't remember a Lynx port, but we did have a Sega Mega Drive version under development, and that was cancelled for I don't know why. But that I've not seen a ROM for it, you know, that got leaked or anything, but I distinctly remember we were developing that, yes.
You know, talking about it being released on so many different platforms, you know, like even the big systems of the day, like Amiga and MS-DOS, and you know, the 3DO got a port as well. I mean, was it a challenge kind of translating the music and sound effects across all these different platforms, and how did that kind of work? How did you manage it? It
wasn't so much a challenge, just time-consuming, because there's quite a lot of music in the game. I did write all the Amiga music first, and then I had to then convert all that to Super Nintendo, which took a while. And then I had to make the CD versions of the music as well. So that was using, you know, like real quote instruments. I mean, obviously synthesizers and sample discs, but it just took a long time. I remember compared to what I was used to, because these are all new tools to me. So, you know, it takes time to get up to speed and to become sort of fast at working with certain tools.
With that whole CD soundtrack coming in, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so it took me a while to get up to speed with that.
Well, you mentioned about, you know, the like the ball mechanics. It really, that could have made or break that or broke that game, couldn't it? Really, because if that didn't work properly, the whole concept would have fallen apart. I mean, were there any kind of big changes that you can remember during the game's design, and any kind of hurdles like that you had to kind of overcome?
I don't remember any particular hurdles. I mean, it was really, I would have liked the game to be able to do more with the ball, because it's a little difficult to use, and it makes the game, doesn't really have a great flow, because you seem to have to sort of stop a lot and sort of get your position right and then kick it. So I would have liked to have, you know, more you could do with it. it does have this mode where you can just do little trick shots and headers and stuff, but it doesn't really affect the gameplay. So I would have liked to maybe have more power-ups or something. I've thought about it in the years past, and I think we could have done a little bit more with the ball mechanics, because it did have very good physics, how it bounced around, and I thought it was a cool idea, but I don't think we really fully explored everything we could do there. But a lot of things back then, it was just time, it takes a lot of time to do this, and back in the day it seemed maybe adequate, it was okay, but now I think we could have done more with it with enough time.
I think the fact that it works so well using a one button joystick, which the Amiga had, I think, just even being able to work the moves out and do so much on such a limited controller, that must have took quite a thoughtful design to make that work properly.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that was always a big challenge with the Amiga, with it only having one fire button is pretty limiting to a lot of games. If the Amiga could have just had two or three buttons, it would have made a whole world of difference to a lot of games, I think.
Were there ever any plans for a sequel then? Because, you mentioned like a few of the ideas there, and it always felt like a game that could have easily had a follow-on game that, like you said, could have maybe explored a bit more with the ball.
Yeah, not that I heard of. There could have been discussions among the management at Chrysalis about a sequel, but nothing that I was privy to, yeah.
Soccer Dad, that would have been good. I was wondering then how you got involved with the Mortal Kombat series as well, and did you realise how crazily big it was going to be at the time?
No, not at the time. We developed our own Sega Mega Drive sound driver, which my good friend Sean Hollingworth actually wrote all the code for that. And he made a custom development system, which I could use. So we were making Sega Mega Drive games for the games that Chrysalis were actually developing. But we sort of branched out and were able to offer that as a service to other developers, of which one of them was Probe Software. Who were doing a lot of conversions and different games at the time. So they contacted us to do the Mortal Kombat Sega Mega Drive music from the arcade. And at the time, Mortal Kombat wasn't a big game. It was just another arcade game, the first one. So we said, yeah, we'll do the sound. And probably took two or three weeks to convert all the sound from the arcade. And, that went into Mortal Kombat 1 and that shipped. And I think it did reasonably well. But then, of course, when Mortal Kombat 2 came around, that was a much bigger game and quite controversial as well, just because of the blood and the gore, and ended up in US Congress. And so that was a big deal. So I was aware then that, this is a big deal. I got to make sure I really put some extra effort and make this one sound good. So that was one of the bigger games that I'd worked on at that point.
You mentioned Probe Software there, and let's talk about Alien 3. Again, another game I absolutely loved on the Amiga as a kid. Not everyone loves a movie, obviously, but I thought the game was fantastic, reviewed very well too. So what was it like working on such a big franchise as like the Alien movies? And did you get any inspiration from the film? And how did you go about approaching like making the music and sound for that game?
Yeah, that was an exciting game to work on, Alien 3. I did see the movie. I wasn't a big fan of the third movie. I think, as a lot of people were a little disappointed, coming off the second one, which is an amazing sort of action movie. So I think it's sort of obvious when you look at the game, they've taken their cues really from Aliens, because it doesn't seem to have a whole lot to do with the movie when you play the game. It's a very action oriented game, which it needs to be because it's an arcade game. So I just took my cues and said, look, but this is an action game. I'm going to do action music. And I thought it had a kind of a Contra kind of feel to it. And I was a big fan of those. So I thought I want to do music that's, upbeat, a lot of energy in the music, and something that's, going to fit this style of game. So I did watch the Alien 3 movie a couple more times, but then I, watched Aliens even more times than that, because that was really where I was getting my inspiration from. And, managed to sample some of the sounds actually out of the Aliens movie, which is when you kill an alien in the game, it makes the sort of alien exploding sound. And that's straight out the movie. And I managed to make some sounds, for the, the different weapons that Ripley uses that I thought sounded pretty good. Yeah.
Did you have to ask permission for that, or did you just kind of do it anyway?
No, we just did it. Everybody, nobody asked permission for anything. We just stole everything.
Yeah, who's going to know?
Yeah, exactly. Because it actually, the game, I did actually transcribe the 20th Century Fox logo, and it's still in the, if you download the music for that game, it's still there, but it actually wasn't in the game because they didn't have the license to use it. So that's why you never hear it if you play the game, but it's actually in the, if you download the soundtrack, it's in there.
What software were you using? Was it like ProTrack or Octomed, that kind of thing? And also, how was it doing the music on the consoles as well? And were you using the Amiga for that? How did that kind of work?
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah, I was using ProTracker for the Amiga, which a lot of folks were doing back then. And then for the consoles, we just developed our own drivers and development systems. So again, it was, you know, Sean Hollingworth who did a lot of the work there. And he created a custom dev system for Sega Mega Drive music, which was based on an Atari ST. And we had it sort of wired up to a Mega Drive, which had some custom software running. So I was able to, you know, compose and edit music sort of in real time. So it wasn't like other composers would have to sort of maybe work in MIDI and then convert it from MIDI to Mega Drive or Sega Genesis, but I was able to just compose directly on the system, which I think helped a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. And I guess that sound driver was kind of Mega Drive focused, and then the Amiga one, it was just kind of put on there and downgraded a little bit.
Yeah. The Amiga one would have just used whatever the standard ProTracker, you know, music player was at the time that we didn't write. That was just the open source, you know, public domain version of the sound driver.
And were there any like kind of tricks that you were using on the audio chip in the Mega Drive to kind of get the best sound out of it?
I would usually put a lot of memory into the percussion and the drums and really making those sound as good as possible. So could have been using maybe slightly higher sample rates to just get those percussion sounds real beefy. And, you know, a lot of EQ to make them sound good. But no, I don't think we, you know, did anything particularly special. And in fact, we didn't even use all the sound hardware because the Sega Genesis actually does have the Master System hardware, sound hardware built in, but we never used it. So we could have had some extra sound channels of beepers and AY sounds, but never did it.
Well, throughout the 90s, you were kind of known for fast-paced, rhythmic compositions. I was wondering, were there any influences like outside gaming? Were you going clubbing or anything like that?
Not particularly. I used to listen to a lot of house music at the time. You know, anything that was really sample based, synthesizers, those kind of things. But most of what I would listen to be honest, was like other people's video game soundtracks. I was pretty sad like that. Wasn't really into you know, chart music, those kind of things. I would you know, listen to game music from Japan or the States or anywhere I could, you know, find it and listen to it and record it. That they were my influences, and other sound designers and other game musicians. I would listen to those for inspiration.
Were there any particular ones that stood out to you that you remember, you know, composers?
Oh yeah, there was the old school from the Commodore 64. You know, there's Rob Herbert and Ben Dalglish and Martin Galway and Yaron Tell, who I loved, and Charles Deanon, you know, Maniacs of Noise. Tim Follin was probably my favorite and still is. I think Tim Follin's an incredibly good musician, amazing sound drivers, amazing music. And then from Japan, I like Yuzo Koshiro, who was famous for doing the Streets of Rage music, and Super Shinobi. He's an incredibly good musician. So yeah, a lot of influence from the top game audio developers around the world.
Well, in the mid-90s, obviously, the industry had some huge changes. I mean, obviously, we had the move from 2D to 3D graphics. And also, in terms of audio, when CD consoles came along, I mean, how did the move to CD audio change your workflow and your creativity? And did you prefer it, or do you prefer having limitations?
Yeah, it really did change everything, because it really opened up the market for who could create music for games, because, you know, you don't really need the technical skill with the sound chips. You just go out there and contract whoever to create your soundtrack. And of course, you can then get really amazing musicians and producers, or you can use known artists. So it really changed changed a lot for me, and I didn't prefer it. I prefer working with the limitations. But I think also just the types of games were coming out there, because those early CD-ROM-based games, a lot of them were not that great. They were called interactive entertainment.
Yes.
So the gameplay wasn't really interesting to me. There was a lot of full motion video and sort of bad acting, and they weren't really games as I saw them. Those early efforts in the sort of early 90s when CD-ROM first came around, I really was not that interested in those kind of games. So it made a big change to me. Yes.
Was there any kind of particular genre that you really liked to work on and found the most fulfilling?
I just loved fast arcade games, platformers, shoot 'em ups, those classic types of games. I did work on some RPGs and a few things. I worked on Ultima 6 for the Amiga, which I enjoyed that. So I did like to play RPGs at home quite a lot. So that was kind of a big thrill to be able to work on Ultima, which was quite a big franchise at the time. But mostly, really, really like the arcade games, 2D arcade games, which they all kind of went away for a while once 3D and CD came in. It took a bit of a backseat. Of course, it's popular again now, but in the early 90s, it was thought of as being, the past, and we need to move past that and have 3D and full motion video.
Would you ever want to work on a Soccer Kid remake or a kind of new version or a follow-up of Soccer Kid these days?
I don't know, maybe in some capacity, but probably not as a full-time thing, because making games is, it's extremely hard to make games, frankly. it was then, and I think it still is now. It's a lot of time, effort, a big commitment, and you really don't know at the end if the game's going to be popular, if it's going to make any money, if it's going to be worth your time. I could possibly work on it if somebody else was sort of driving the project, and I would be happy to contribute, but I don't think I'd want to lead the project.
Did you move away from working on games, Angs? I know it looks like you did a load up until the mid-2000s.
Yeah, I did, yeah. So I'd moved to the States. I worked for Sony briefly first in the southwest of England, when Sony had a studio down in Stroud, which we were working on some of the first PlayStation games down there. And then in 96, I moved to the States and I was working for Disney, and they were doing a lot of, like I said, this interactive CD-ROM type stuff, which really didn't interest me. So at that point, I was sort of losing interest in games because that's what everybody was doing. I just sort of took my talents and just adapted my talent, sort of what slight talent I had as an engineer, and adapted that to work on, web, at the time the World Wide Web was becoming big and websites and web applications. So I just turned to that and started doing that as a full-time job, and the music just sort of, I just let that slide away.
Well, I did read that you're part of the demo scene again. Are you in a demo group at the moment? What's kind of the story there?
Oh, no. I think I did a little bit for a group called 8-Bit, who are a sort of informal sort of demo group. And actually, Matt Simmons is also a member as Format, who's been doing some of the work. And it was a long time ago now, maybe 6, 7, 8 years ago. I did a few tunes for some demos that came out. They were sort of based on the Spectrum, I think, some kind of mega Spectrum that the programmer had made, where it could make these Spectrum demos that were better than was ever possible on an original, because he added an extra sound chip and an extra, increased the processor speed and a few things, yeah.
What was it like kind of going back to those days, like the demo days again?
It's really, really hard. I think Chris Hulsbeck had said on his interview that you just lose that muscle memory. Right. And so back in the day, I could use these really primitive tools incredibly quickly. And now when you, I load up a tracker software on my laptop, and you're just like, wow, this is so complicated and slow. And I'm doddering around on the keyboard trying to find what to do, and I can't remember how to do anything, and it's really hard because you just lose that muscle memory. And so it took a really long time just to make those bits of demo music, which I think back in the day I could have knocked those out in, like, you know, 20 minutes or something, but it took me weeks.
Yeah, part of your brain you've got to reactivate again.
Absolutely, yeah, that's it.
Well, Matt, you have worked on some incredible titles, and like I said at the start, you know, games that shaped our childhood, so it's been amazing talking to you and hearing some of your memories, so thanks so much for coming on.
Well, thank you so much too. Yeah, it's been really great to be on the show.